be talking about a couple of separate results, half of which are contained in this publication on the archive, and half of which are still in preparation. But I thought I'd begin with a bit of a light, tongue-in-cheek historical introduction to quantum foundations, because this, just to kind of motivate the question of why we want to consider different representations of quantum mechanics. So in order to do that, I'm going to tell you the quantum creation story. So in the beginning was the ultraviolet catastrophe. Well, at least that's what textbooks say, but you know, the real story is more like, in the beginning with a bunch of, you know, experimental physicists who looked at black body spectra at different temperature and came up with a bunch of statistics that no one had yet been able to explain. But that's a bit more of a mouthful. So anyway, along came Planck and Einstein, and they said, let there be quanta of energy. And then there was quantum mechanics and a lot of buzzing. Yeah. Is that better? Oh, I think it might be this little plate. Yeah, maybe. Okay, and then there was quantum mechanics.
Amanda?
Does anyone in the AV room know what's happening with the noise?
What are you guys hearing?
A crackling through the speaker.
Okay, weird. I can hear it through your microphone too, but I'm not sure what I can do about it at the moment. Here, let me check something up here.
Well, I guess this gives time for anyone else to show up, so. Do I just continue, or?
Yeah, you may as well.
Okay, so, and then there was quantum mechanics. And the founding
can you try it again?
Is it working better now?
Sounds good.
I can't hear it now, but can you guys hear it?
No, we can't at the moment, so.
Okay, perfect. We'll leave it as that and then go from there.
Okay, thank you. So the founding fathers looked at the theory that they had made and said, it is not good. And after much wandering in the wilderness and worshipping at the altars of Heisenberg and Schrodinger and visiting places like Solvay, von Neumann led the people to Mount Foundations and presented them with the standard formulation of quantum mechanics. So one way of presenting the standard postulation is in terms of four abstract commandments. And while I present these commandments, I'd like to think about how they relate to, say, the chair you're sitting on. So commandment number one, thou shalt describe an isolated system by some trace one element of the space of bounded linear operators acting on a d-dimensional complex Hilbert space. Commandment number two, thou shalt describe composite systems by some trace one element of the space of bounded linear operators acting on the tensor product of the d-dimensional vector spaces. Commandment number three, thou shalt describe the evolution of a system by some completely positive trace-preserving superoperator acting on the space of bounded linear operators acting on a d-dimensional vector space. And command number four, thou shalt describe a measurement by a POVM, a positive operator-valued measurement, which is a collection of effects that sum to the unit operator, and thou shalt predict that the probability that the outcome at k occurs is given by the Born rule. So, you know, these are very straightforward, clear commands, right? It's obvious. So Ball looked at the theory and said, well, it is very good. And let anyone who seeks further explanation be described in uncomplimentary terms. But then a new generation of physicists arose, and this generation knew not the ways of the founding fathers. They were not like the previous generation. And they sacrificed time, grant money, and countless grad students to rival interpretations of quantum mechanics, including the many worlds interpretation, de Broglie-Bohm mechanics, pilot wave models, and phase-space quantization, just to name a few of the idols. Okay, so now I've given that kind of tongue-in-cheek overview. I'm going to talk about the approaches to quantum foundations that please everybody. And they're summarized on this slide. And now we're going to talk about the main approaches. So the basic question in quantum foundations is how do the abstract postulates of quantum mechanics relate to the real world? So you've got these abstract postulates about, you know, spaces of elements of bounded linear operators, and you've got tables and chairs that you're sitting on. And the standard textbook approach is just, please don't ask about the relation between them. You know, it's too hard, it's going to cause problems, just don't ask. And then there's another approach, which goes, well, look at these postulates. They contain some element of a space of bounded linear operators. Obviously, that's part of the real world. And the things that describe that, how that thing evolves and how it reacts to measurements, well, obviously, that's just fundamental laws of nature. So don't seek any further explanation because you've already got the full one. And then the third approach is to go, well, okay, there's a world and it's kind of going along happily. And then people come along. And what are people like? Well, people are just, you know, basically they're just people, things that hit other things. So, you know, you come along to the world with a club, you hit a small lizard, and you go, okay, that flew across the room, the plains, pretty fast. And then you go and you hit a grizzly bear. And, you know, your relatives go, oh, okay, he's mauled, but obviously the hitting didn't send him very far, send the grizzly bear very fast. So maybe force, mass, acceleration, maybe there's some relation, and they come up with Newton's laws. And, you know, then they get better and better and better at hitting things and better at observing what happens when they hit things, and they come up with the laws of quantum mechanics. And hopefully that's not where the story ends. so there are two types of cavemen. There's the bottom-up cavemen. They seek to derive quantum mechanics from some fundamental set of axioms, and we very imaginatively call this quantum axiomatics. So the basic idea here is that you have maybe some ontological model or some description of information, and there are some principles that model must satisfy. And if you can find the right set of principles, then that will uniquely determine the way in which the world or your information about the world should behave. Then there's the other approach, which is, okay, we've come up with quantum mechanics. What kind of world could that correspond to? What kind of world could that describe? And these approaches are complementary, but I'm going to use the top-down approach. So the goal is to map quantum mechanics to distributions over a phase space, or to maybe map sub-theories of quantum mechanics to distributions over phase space. Well, it's kind of the start with the description of the world and kind of try and work your way, like, at the bottom, the sort of the fundamental level, and work your way to get quantum mechanics. Or else you're starting with kind of the quantum mechanics, which is the top level, and trying to extrapolate beneath that. That's kind of my view on it. It's not standard terminology. I'm trying to drill my way to the bottom, if that makes sense. Like, given quantum mechanics, try and drill down and see what's underneath it, rather than kind of take some assumptions about things underneath and then try and get quantum mechanics out of it. So I mentioned that, you know, I'm happy enough with trying to explain a sub-theory of quantum mechanics. Well, what's a sub-theory? It's just basically quantum mechanics, but it's not all there. So you take a set of quantum preparations, which could be, well, a subset of quantum preparations. You take a group of the unitary operators that you can do in quantum mechanics, and we consider groups because we assume we're closed under composition. And you take a subset of the set of all quantum measurements that you can use. And the assumption we're going to make is that the set of measurements and states are convex. So if I take two elements of my set of preparations that I'm allowed to do, then any convex combination of them is also an allowed preparation. And physically, what this corresponds to is I could imagine that I have a black box that, which has two buttons on it. If I hit one button, it spits out a system in the state row. If I hit the other button, it spits out a system in the state row prime. And then I could condition which button I hit based on a coin flip. And let's assume I can prepare an arbitrarily weighted coin, which is, of course, difficult. But anyway, let's assume that I can do that. Then I can forget the outcome, and then that preparation is a valid way of preparing a system. So why consider sub-theories rather than all of quantum mechanics? Well, one of the main reasons if you come up with a classical model or a sensible model for a sub-theory of quantum mechanics, then you're going to have to break and distort it to get all of quantum mechanics into it. You're going to have something that's not sensible, right? And the way you have to do this gives you one definition of what non-classicality is. Also, sub-theories are actually what get implemented experimentally. You don't implement every Hamiltonian permitted by quantum mechanics. You don't implement every unitary directly. You don't prepare every state directly or do every measurement. You do some building blocks that give you some of quantum mechanics or some theory of quantum mechanics. And it's quite important, if you're doing an experiment and you're claiming, oh, I have some quantum effect, that actually you have some proof that it is quantum, that it's not, you know, explainable by some simple model that you just haven't thought of. Also, quantum computers are based on sub-theories. So if you consider the circuit model or measurement-based quantum computation, what you do for these, you prepare some input or resource state from some set of resource states. You possibly use some sequence of unitaries, and you choose measurements from some set. So again, this is just sub-theory language. And so the canonical example of a sub-theory is the stabilizer sub-theory. Excuse me. So in the stabilizer sub-theory, if you take the group of Pauli observables, you can define the Clifford group as just the normalizer of tensor products of that group. And then the n-qubit stabilizer sub-theory is the set of stabilizer states, the group of Clifford transformations, and the set of Pauli observables. And if you want the convex sub-theory, well, then you just add convex everywhere that you need to. So convex set of stabilizer states and set of all convex combinations of Pauli observables. Now, I've been mentioning that, you know, we want a sensible or a classical assumption. And there are many different definitions of that, and people generally don't agree. But the one I'm going to use for the purpose of this talk is a generalized non-contextuality. So to motivate this, consider a prepare and measure scenario. So you prepare a system in some state rho, and you measure a POVM. And you want to calculate the probability with which an outcome occurs. And to do that, you just use the fourth commandment, the Born rule, right? And in that rule, nothing depends on the specific representation of your density operator or your effect. It doesn't depend on whether you implement the POVM directly or whether you implement some fine-grained POVM and then coarse-grain over the outcomes. It doesn't depend on how you can decompose your density operator into other states. It doesn't depend on whether rho, your density operator, is a proper or improper mixture. So, for instance, it was perfectly valid to use the density operator obtained by forgetting which pure state a system is in. That's a perfectly valid thing to do. Or, you know, if you can obtain a mixed state from interacting with some environment through some mechanism, and tracing out over the environment. And the prediction you make doesn't depend on what environment you interacted with, how you interacted with, it only depends on rho. It doesn't even depend on if there are possible physical processes, I stress possible because this is controversial, that actually take pure states to mixed states. That's completely independent. None of that matters. So in the words of John Lennon, all you need is rho. Right? So it would be perfectly possible, perfectly sensible to have a theory in which the way you came up, like that these different processes would give different predictions. But that's not what we have. Quantum mechanics doesn't give different predictions for different ways you can obtain mixed states. So we want to explain this. And the way we're going to explain it is to assume it arises from phase space or hidden variables. So what this means is that all of these different ways of getting a density operator just map onto exactly the same distribution over phase space. And to see a sort of more thorough discussion of this, see Rob's paper on contextuality for transformations, preparations, and measurements. Yeah. It's because it's a leftover diagram from a poster I put together and I forgot to change the axis. That's kind of a leading question, but anyway. Okay, so such a model is necessarily a quasi-probability representation, or can be extended to a quasi-probability representation, now that Rob's brought up some of the distinctions. So a quasi-probability representation is defined over some phase space using dual Hermitian frames, where a frame is just a generalization of a basis. And it's defined, so the preparation frame is a set of operators F lambda, and they just map quantum states to quasi-probability distributions via the trace product. And the measurement frame, the set of operators G lambda, maps effects to conditional probabilities via the same thing. And we want to get the Born rule back out at the end. So the expression on the left is, of the third line, is simply the law of total probability. So if I prepare a state rho, measure a state E, I can condition on any kind of intermediate state, and I should get the same thing back if I account for all intermediate possibilities. Now, you can prove that some of these things have to take negative values somewhere. So mu or eta have to be negative for some values of rho or E, so some states and or effects. What's kind of interesting is, or what's quite interesting is, you can actually make all states have non-negative distributions, but this kind of shifts the negativity into the description of the measurements. Okay, and last part of a sub-theory is the transformations. So unitaries correspond to deterministic evolution of quantum states. Well, what about in these models? If you consider a discrete phase space, then you can just write your quasi-probability distribution as a vector, real-valued vector. And if you've actually got all the information in your phase space, then you don't need to talk about anything else. You have Markovian dynamics and your transition between phase space points is well defined. So you just have transformations correspond to quasi-stochastic matrices. And the reason I say quasi-stochastic is you can prove fairly quickly that you need negative probabilities for some unitary transformations over any finite state space. And now if we look at the evolution of quantum states, it only depends on the unitary operator. It doesn't depend on, say, the specific Hamiltonian or whether you implement a unitary through directly or through a sequence of unitaries. So we're going to assume that the same thing arises, that this arises from phase space as well. And this implies that the map from unitaries to the quasi-stochastic matrices is a faithful representation. So quasi-stochastic matrices composed by multiplication, the identity transformation of quantum states corresponds to doing nothing to phase space, and inverses go nicely. Now, so that's kind of the basic formalism of a quasi-probability representation. Now, if you restrict a quasi-probability representation to the sub-theory for which it's non-negative, that gives you a non-contextual model for that sub-theory, a non-contextual ontological model. So you've gotten rid of all the negative probabilities, and you're kind of left with something with positive probabilities where things only depend on the abstract operators, not the specific decompositions.
Quasi-stochastic matrix associated with the inverse.
Yes.
The inverse of the matrix. Now, if that matrix wasn't just 0 and 1 probabilities, then wouldn't the inverse give me probabilities greater than 1? And
so this is why it's quite... I'll talk a bit about that later, but... So quasi-stochastic matrices have negative values as well. So a stochastic matrix, your normalization condition is that the sum of the rows is 1. So basically, a system will always go in some phase space point, will always go to another phase space point. If you allow negative probabilities, you can also allow things greater than 1. So if you actually look at it as well, even if this was, if this was non-negative, its inverse is generally negative. But I'll come back to that later. Does that answer your question? So then the question is, what kinds of sub-theories can we have that are non-negative in some quasi-probability representation? Or another way of asking that is, what sub-theories can we describe in a non-contextual ontological model? Right, they're the same question, or equivalent questions. And the primary tool we're going to use is non-negative bases, because it's without further restrictions, you can actually throw quite a lot of things in. So for instance, as I said, you can throw all of the states into your sub-theory as long as you don't have all the measurements. But we kind of want to know the trade-off that you have to do. And so we're going to consider non-negative bases, which are things where orthonormal bases where each element is a classical state, so it has corresponds to a proper probability distribution, and each element corresponds to a valid conditional probability, so between 0 and 1. So the basis corresponds to a set of valid classical preparations and a set of and a classical measurement. And there's some quite non-trivial properties you get from these. So two elements of a non-negative basis are orthogonal if and only if the corresponding probability distributions are disjoint. And for any point in phase space, exactly one element of any non-negative basis assigns non-zero probability to that phase point, to that point, which follows from the previous. But the extra bit is that the probability that the element of the non-negative basis assigns is independent of which basis you consider. So if I take two different bases and find the one that assigns non-zero probability to a point, it's the same probability. And so what this means is that if I take, say, discrete phase space, and then different non-negative bases just correspond to ways of partitioning up that phase space. And that was leftover that I forgot to take out. So based on these, we can now prove a couple of nice theorems restricting how much of quantum mechanics you can put into a non-negative subtheory. So in particular, you can't have any more than two non-negative bases in a plane of the Bloch sphere. And the reason is essentially geometrical. Like, we have the nice geometrical map to the Bloch sphere. If you have three non-negative bases, then this point corresponds to a quantum state that can be decomposed as a convex combination of orthogonal states and non-orthogonal states. And that allows you to get a contradiction. Oh, I should just make a note. I'm going to skip the technical details of a lot of things because, yeah. And you can also show that if you have four non-negative bases, then there's actually only one possibility. They have to be the vertices of a right cuboid on the surface of a Bloch sphere. So you can only have four, you can't have any more. Which basically means, even for a single qubit, you basically have to assign negative probabilities to most bases, either the states or the measurements. And the nice thing about this example as well is that it has the symmetry group of the Pauli group. So you can do pi rotations about x, y, and z, and that will just map those bases amongst each other. And this leads to the next question. So we talked about unitaries, and if you just have a quasi-probability representation for preparation and measurements, then that's kind of boring. You know, you don't have any dynamics. You kind of, nothing really happens. So we want there to be some non-negative dynamics in your model, which we're going to assume is some non-trivial unitary group. And you can, any unitary that's a non-negative transformation has to permute the non-negative bases. And so it'll correspond to a point group of, like, it'll either be the Pauli group or the point group of, on the Bloch sphere, three or fewer bases corresponds to three or fewer pairs of antipodal points. So it'll be one of those point groups. Now, one of the things that's nice here is, as I mentioned, there's this interesting fact about non-negative matrices, which is that a non-negative matrix has a non-negative inverse if and only if it's a permutation matrix. So this actually, if we want to put dynamics in our theory, then we get this nice intuition that actually the deterministic evolution of quantum states has to come about from deterministic evolution on phase space. At least the non-negative part does. So as an example of a quasi-probability representation, I'll show you the discrete Wigner function. It's defined over four points, so a phase space of 4 points, by these operators, which just... And the quasi-probability distribution is just a sort of nice linear relation. And you can see, for instance, the computational basis state has vector with 0, 0, 1. So the only point that's going to get picked out is the last component of D. And so this is either going to be a half or zero, depending on whether A plus B equals 1 or 0. So how about the transformations? Also, as I said, any non-negative unitary is a deterministic transformation on phase space, which means it permutes the phase space operators. We can draw the phase space operators as a set of points on the Bloch sphere, and it's just a regular tetrahedron. And so the symmetry group is the tetrahedral group. And in particular, this doesn't contain all the Clifford group. It doesn't contain the phase gate. So if you do a pi on 2 rotation about Z, you get outside the theory, or you don't permute the phase space operators. And there's an obvious fix to this. We just extend to 8 points, and where the 8 points now correspond to the vertices of the cube. So the tetrahedron, like the four previous points plus the rotated version. And this has the proper symmetry group, so now we can actually implement all Clifford gates. And this has sort of quite close relations. Well, it's kind of equivalent to Rob's toy theory, except this 8-point model now has all unitary transformations in the Clifford group. So what about other possibilities? Well, it turns out we can actually give a complete classification of the subtheories with non-trivial unitary groups, and it's got to be one of these three cases for different values. So this has dihedral symmetry of order 3, so pi on 3 rotations about the z-axis, cyclic symmetry of order 2, or the Pauli group. And you can make any, there's different special cases of these, different parameters, different ways you can set them up. It's basically always corresponds to a non-negative sub-theory, except in these two, when you try and squash them too close to the plane, and it's not even that close to the plane, where things essentially stop working. You can't define the phase space operators anymore. And so you have this kind of interesting relation where more, as you try and make, if, as you push them closer to the plane, you're actually making them less complementary, right? So, but it's actually, that makes it harder to tell you, harder to explain classically. So in a sense, the more complementarity, the easier it is to explain classically, which is kind of the opposite from what the standard intuition.
So out of all the possible permutations of these 8 points, the ones that simulate Clifford gate elements is a subset.
Yes, it's exactly half. Well, actually, yeah, it's up. The other half correspond to anti-unitary versions of Clifford. So the Clifford group is isomorphic to the hedral subgroup of it's the octahedral group, the chiral version. But you also have the version including reflections about planes, and that is a valid permutation of the phase space operators, but it can't be written as a valid permutation as a unitary. So I don't quite know what that would do to general quantum states, for instance.
I have another question. In the theories where you find you need negativity, is it the case that the representations of the measurements are the same as the representation of the state. So if I have a basis,
yes.
Can you put the negativity just into the measurements and leave the states positive, or is there a sort of symmetry between the representation of the states and the measurements?
These cases for the qubit are actually quite nice. By requiring non-negative bases, I actually require the frames to be proportional, well, closely related to each other. So for any given phase space point, the preparation and measurement operators are just related by a constant.
Okay. So they both go negative, right?
So it's very symmetric in its treatment of preparations and measurements. It's being forced to do that. Okay, so that's just for a single qubit. And you know, usually you want to consider multiple systems because that's where a lot of the interesting things happen. How can you define quasi-probability representations for two systems? Well, the obvious way is to just take tensor products of your single system frames. Now, this is an obvious way, and in many ways it's a good way, but it causes a problem. It commits you straight from the outset. You've gone, okay, the first thing I can think of is a tensor product structure, and that straight away enforces local causality. So for any joint measurement of the system, two systems, the conditional probabilities must then factorize. And the same argument also applies to the preparations. If I take independent preparations of quantum states, then that corresponds to independent distributions over local phase spaces. And some of you may be familiar with this. This is exactly the kind of assumption that's built into the recent PBR theorem. And so that gives you a restriction straight away from assuming a tensor product structure, gives you a non-trivial restriction on what you can have in the non-negative sub-theory. So the question is, can we avoid these problems just by using a different way of constructing quasi-probability representations for multiple systems? And so to define a quasi-probability representation, we take some phase space that's not necessarily a Cartesian product of local phase spaces anymore, and we take frames for n systems that are not necessarily tensor products. But we can show that if we want to be able to do local tomography using non-negative bases in our subtheory, in the non-negative subtheory, then you actually get local causality no matter what you do. You don't get that it's a tensor product structure immediately of single systems, but you get that you must have local causality. So the probability, quasi-probability for joint measurements must always factorize for any given phase space point in your non-local phase space. And this actually gives some very interesting implications, some quite non-trivial consequences. And one of them is that the n-qubit stabilizer subtheory must be negative in any quasi-probability representation for three or more qubits. You can also show it for two qubits, but I'm not going to get into that. But this is, so the reason it must be is because you can use the stabilizer subtheory for qubits, for three qubits, to either violate a Bell inequality or to implement a GHZ paradox. And so you must violate local causality in any kind of ontological model. And this is very different from the Q-trick case. There's been some quite recent work showing that for Q-trits, the stabilizer subtheory is non-negative in the discrete Wigner function, so the first function quasi-probability representation anyone thinks of. And this gives a generalization of the Gottesman-Knill theorem that actually includes more gates than anyone knew previously. Okay, so we have this qualitative difference in the stabilizer subtheories between qubits and q-trits. Can we extend that to anything more? For instance, are there any of the other qubit subtheories that allow entangling gates? And this is quite a difficult question because there aren't complete characterizations of subtheories like this. So it was easy to show that the stabilizer subtheory is non-negative, must be negative for qubits because it's been well studied in the context of you know, Bell's theorem and GHZ paradoxes. But for other sub-theories, well, we don't even really know what kinds of entangling gates you can have.
So,
yeah?
When you said local tomography, can you define that? Does that mean with the allowed measurements
of
the theory?
Yeah, exactly. So you have a set of non-negative bases. So the assumption is that you have tensor products of non-negative bases acting for single systems, and those are locally tomographically complete. So for if I take a single system, I can do local tomography, like in the stabilized sub-theory. Or for that matter, any of these are locally tomographically complete because they essentially, you can use them to get the full statistics for any element of the sub-theory, or for that matter, even for any element of, even in quantum theory, these are tomographically complete. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
So
the question was, in the theorem that you quoted, you said if it, you have local tomography,
yeah,
then you have to have this causal behavior. So.
Yeah.
So that was the definition I was asking about, but I think you said.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yeah. So in this theorem, I'm assuming. Yeah. You can do preparations and measurements in a set of bases at each site. And then you can combine those using the tensor product, and that's non-negative. That's the assumption. It's one of those things where...
So you built in the tensor product to the assumption. So.
The tensor product structure is built in because when you define a frame, the frame operators act on the space of quantum states that you're considering. And that has the tensor product structure built in. But if you require that it carries over into your sub-theory in a sort of informationally complete way, then it forces it through for everything. So it's kind of, the proof is essentially a linearity style argument. I probably skipped too many technical details. So we're wanting to find other sub-theories that have entangling gates for qubits. So, well, the starting point on this, and this is something that seems like it should be known but isn't. So the Clifford group is the normalizer of a set of observables, right? And you include the identity matrix just because essentially you could choose not to observe a system. Right, and that's just a set of Hermitian observables. You don't multiply observables normally. Well, I never do. When you're observing something in a lab, you don't multiply it. So there's no reason to require it to be a group under matrix multiplication. So let's just replace the set of Pauli matrices by another set of Hermitian observables corresponding to observables in other bases. And then the question is, can I, under this replacement, and then I can define a normalizer to be something that leaves tensor products of this set invariant, can I ever get entangling gates in the normalizer? And the answer is, if your set of observables is tomographically complete, and you have some non-trivial unitary that goes between them, then no, you can't. The only thing you can do is use Pauli matrices. So it's kind of seeming like there's not just this kind of qualitative difference for the stabilizer sub-theory, but perhaps there's even no sub-theory of qubits that's non-negative for entangling gates.
So the extensions of sub-theory that you think about are theories that would involve, say, one of your other choices of bases for a single qubit, products of those.
Yeah.
And then you're just wondering, could I also add some...
Can I add an entangling gate? and
therefore get some entangled states as well.
Exactly.
An entangled measurement.
Yeah. And it's not trivial to rule out because just because I have like entanglement and local causality are quite distinct concepts. So
sure.
That in particular the Q-trip case has entangling gates but not non-locality. So it is local in the sense that you have a local, well, the Wigner function is the locally causal model for it.
And can you tell me why you want that unitary to be part of the normalizer of these product observables?
The main reason, as I said, is that this is kind of a first step. So this is, at the moment, this is my first step to seeking to answer, can you get entangling gates in any quasi-probability representation? This doesn't work. I have further evidence, but it's numerical evidence that suggests that actually you can't do it anyway, but it's really, let's just say it's nowhere near elegant enough to present. It's
so in this claim or quasi-claim, is some locality assumption being used? Because otherwise you just have some 2 to the n dimensional space. You could sort of choose any weird, you could break it up in a tensor product.
When you take tensor products of this, there's the sense in which, you have observables at each site and you can observe them independently.
And that's one of your inputs required.
Part of, yeah. So that's a fairly standard thing in the Clifford group case. But the justification is just that I can independently choose measurements. And if you can independently choose measurements, your normalizer doesn't ever contain entangling gates, unless it's the Pauli group. The other reason for considering the normalizer is because even if it doesn't necessarily give everything, we know that if you have the normalizer for a set, then you can use an efficient simulation protocol of prepare any state, apply a sequence of gates in the normalizer, and then measure from your set of observables. So that's kind of, I'm presenting half the story here. There's quite a few connections that go to different places. So that kind of makes things more complicated to separate cleanly. Those results, in case anyone's interested, is based on a paper, related to a paper by Clark, Joser, and Linden on normalizers for unitary groups of 2 qubits, but it kind of goes a fair bit further. So to wrap up, we've looked at the question, what subtheories can contain a non-trivial unitary group and be non-negative in some quasi-probability representation? And basically, these are them. It's got to be one of these or a sub-theory. Now, the interesting thing is, so if all you need is if you have a non-contextual model, if all you need is rho and E and U, you can only have 4 non-negative bases, even though you can make all quantum states have non-negative distributions. So the only way you can make all states non-negative is by making every single measurement, except for 4, have negative conditional probabilities. Now, that's also, I think, quite an interesting connection in quasi-probability representations between different assumptions you come across in foundational work. So I'm quite interested by this local tomography, the connection between local tomography and local causality. And there's also some implications for preparations, but they're still in progress. So I'm still trying to work out exactly what this local tomography assumption will imply, whether it will always imply independent preparations or not. But one of the things that's quite interesting is there's been this work showing that negativity of a quasi-probability representation in the discrete Wigner function is necessary for a computational speedup. But I've actually, by showing that you can't have the Q qubit stabilizer subtheory being non-negative, this shows that negativity is not sufficient for a quantum computational advantage. So it's kind of an interesting question about the sort of resource between negativity as a resource for quantum computation. And also, there's this issue that entanglement between qubits seems to be fundamentally more quantum, whatever you mean by that, than entanglement between qutrits. So what I mean is that you can come up with classical models for qutrit, for entanglement between qutrit systems. You just use the discrete Wigner function for qutrits, and you get an entangling gate. And it's a classical model. It makes perfect sense as classical correlations. But you can't do that for the qubit stabilizer subtheory. And there's some evidence to suggest that you can't do it for anything with qubits. And not entirely sure what to make of that. But also this kind of interesting thing of the construction of the Clifford group only gives you entangling normalizers for the very special case of the Pauli group as when it's the normalizer of the Pauli group. Okay, so all looking back on the abstract formulation of quantum mechanics I presented, it's all in terms of mixed states, POVMs, everything else. So a natural question to ask is this the wrong formalism? Should we all convert to the Church of the Larger Hilbert space if you're trying to, if you need to actually talk about the details of your decomposition whenever you're trying to come up with an ontological model? Maybe it would make sense to go to pure states. But then at the same time, you still have this problem of why do all of these decompositions, why does that not matter? So it almost seems like you have a fine-tuning argument there. And which part of the point?
Pure states versus mixed states.
So this formalism and the quasi-probability, like negative probabilities, come up when you try and make a model that is non-contextual in the sense that when you have a density operator, how you got that density operator doesn't matter, right? So essentially, this is kind of a conclusion that if you want to rule out...
This is what you call preparation and contextuality?
Yeah, and measurement. It's kind of, they're all lumped in together in quasi-probability representations. But basically, you can't represent all of quantum mechanics in this formulation. Any representation, any faithful representation of this requires negative distribution. So you've got to have unfaithful representations, which means your quantum states go to multiple distributions over your phase space. And so it seems like if you're going to do that, then how do you work out what distributions you're going to? Well, maybe you actually needed to stay back in the pure state formalism.
So you're saying these problems wouldn't arise if you limit yourself to pure states?
So they don't arise... That's the first part, is they don't arise in the pure state formalism, right? But the problem in the pure state formalism is it doesn't seem to explain why your predictions don't depend on any of the details that we use in quantum information. So this is the nice formulation that really makes information theoretic sense.
But there's something I don't understand. I mean, all these paradoxes, like the Bell inequalities, and they can all be done with pure states.
Yes.
So why do you need to introduce these mixed states in order?
So this is, as I said, this is actually distinct from local causality. So the fact that local causality popped out when I considered multiple systems is actually a bit of a surprise. The key thing that we're indicating as sort of quantum here is negative probabilities, and those negative probabilities only come up when you can kind of have too much. They come up because in quantum mechanics you have too much freedom of decomposition.
So you're saying you could,
and if you get rid of that,
you could have an EPR state, you could explain it all with positive probabilities, but it just wouldn't be locally positive. Is that the statement?
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
that's kind of a known state or a.
Yeah, I'm not claiming this is a
new
statement.
I didn't think you were, but I'm just trying to understand what. So the new thing is
the APR state.
I missed the introduction. You probably said it.
The APR state is actually a bad example because the APR state can be described with non-negative probabilities in a quasi-probability representation, but the singlet state, for example, of qubits can't be, or with decent measurements.
Isn't that the same? They're the same thing. It doesn't matter.
The
singlet state is what I meant by the
APRs.
Oh,
sorry, I thought you meant the original APR as in like position momentum correlations.
No. I was thinking.
The Bohm version. Yeah, okay. So you can't describe the APR measurement in a quasi-probability representation, which is a representation of the space of mixed states. You can describe it in a faithful representation of the space of pure states. It will be non-local. But that's, at the moment, that's kind of a secondary concern. The point I was trying to make is if you go down that road and go to the Church of the Larger Hilbert space, though, you kind of have this situation where there are things that you cannot tell the difference between, that you have to actually say correspond to different states of reality, even though there's nothing you can do in principle to distinguish them. And that's kind of this, I don't know, it's something that some people would be quite unhappy with. I think I would be too. So I've talked a bit about the simulation using the discrete Wigner function. And you can ask whether that applies to other representations, and it seems to. But that's kind of just work in progress. There's some other projects I'm working on. So if any of you see anything in this list that interests you, feel free to talk to me about it in the next week or so while I'm here. Okay, any questions?
Do you want to tell us the route towards proving that for two qubits you cannot have a non-negative quasi-probability representation?
Sure. So for that is sorry, I just don't necessarily remember it off the top of my head. So the key point, actually no, I think I'm going to, that's just going to be horrible. Okay, so the key point you need, or you have to start from, okay, so the key starting point is this observation of local tomography implies local causality. So once you have that, it's actually, as I said, I have gone too light on the technical details in response to having previously gone too heavy on the technical details.
Is
there an eraser? Okay, so it's actually, as I said, it's a stronger statement than local causality. What you end up requiring. So, if you say, just for clarity of so It's always just an issue of how to index a bunch of sets. So J is going to index which basis element I have, and alpha is going to index which basis I'm in. So this is a set of B bases for a d-dimensional Hilbert space. Okay, and I want a quasi-probability representation, and I'll just define that as a set A. Okay, so that's a set of bases, and I want my quasi-probability representation for two systems to be non-negative for the all bases in the, all elements of the tensor product of that. Then what you can show, so let's just say let so just going to consider an arbitrary frame, a pair of dual frames for two systems. Right? And these are a quasi-probability representation that's non-negative basically, the way you prove the claim or the theorem is actually that each individual operator must be a tensor product of local operators. And to prove this, you use some probabilities some properties I haven't even properly mentioned.
Okay. Tell me where it goes from there.
Okay, so you show that these are tensor products. Both G and F are tensor products. And then you go, well, let's assume that this is actually the stabilizer subtheory, right? And that's kind of what we want. That means that it's kind of one of those things where I temporarily forget and then go, oh, of course. Okay, so you can write these as where the subscripts denote essentially that you're doing a partial trace over the other subsystem, and you also need a slight normalization, but that's kind of irrelevant. And then you can go, well, if I sum over, I can then look at the quasi-probability distributions for states like 0 tensor I, right? And this has to be a non-negative. This part just essentially drops out by assumption. And so that I get that these guys actually have to be non-negative for all of the stabilizer states. And then I can show, well, if it's non-negative for all the stabilizer states, the operators actually have to be correspond to these points on the cube, because they have to have inner product with each of the x, y, and z axes, right? And once you do that, you get a simple form for any possible phase space operator, and then you just apply the C0 to that, and you note that the C0 doesn't map a valid operator to a valid operator. So you end up with terms. Sorry, just finding it quickly. Okay, so this is actually the specific part is you get like any of the sort of tensor products of the cubes, you can get an expression kind of like this one. So the sort of that can be expressed as a product like this. And then you can show that it doesn't get mapped to a product like that, so it can't be written as a tensor product. And then it's because everything has to be a tensor product, you kind of have lost the game already, even with two qubits. So
let me see if I can summarize it. The way the proof goes is it shows the only way to get a non-negative representation of the stabilizer theory for two qubits is to have a non-negative representation for one qubit.
Yeah.
That forces you to this eight-state representation. It's the only one.
Well, it doesn't force you into the eight state. It forces you into using operators that are in the eight-state representation, or at least proportional to them.
But isn't it true that if I just ask what's the distribution of the state 00 on qubit 1, what's, I don't care about qubit 2. Wouldn't I reproduce the description of the eight-state model?
Like, not necessarily, because you can use the 4-qubit model, the 4-state model. Like there are, what I'm trying to say is there are multiple representations, even for the discrete Wigner function. And even if you want, you could always, for instance, add in extra variables that are junk. You could add in extra variables and have uniform distributions over those. So what I'm trying to say is, I'm not saying that it forces you into the eight-state model, it just forces you into using operators that are tensor products of those up to proportionality. And then once you have that, you can show that the C0 doesn't preserve that set. Does that clarify things?
Four-state model would be ruled out because you can't capture the unity.
Yeah, you don't get all of the qubits, true. And you need the eight-state model to get that. But you can have 16 or 64 if you just add in an extra bit that is completely uncorrelated with everything.
Is there something optimal about having eight underlying
quantities? This is one of the points is that if you only have four, so if you look through like the discrete Wigner function or Rob's toy theory, you can't define all Clifford transformations. So not all permutations of the probability distributions correspond to or supervene on a permutation of the four points. But in this model, you can. And essentially, the reason is because the symmetry group is exactly the same as the symmetry group of the set of states.
Another follow-up question on this. So if I'm not mistaken, Merman has a proof of non-contextuality for two qubits that only uses stabilizer measurements.
Yes,
the magic square proof.
Yep.
So you could also prove that there's no way of having a non-negative quasi-probability representation starting from that?
Yeah, I guess you could. You can. That's a much easier route because the observables, that's actually a state independent proof. So, yeah.
Isn't that proof of traditional contextuality?
Yeah, but this notion of non-contextuality actually implies the stronger notion. So, because I've got, in the language of Rob's paper, I've got both preparation and measurement non-contextuality. If you look at the way I define my conditional probabilities, it's the trace of just the effect with the corresponding measurement frame operator. Not, like, I don't need the rest of the BOVM. It's just the effect.
Okay.
So it already has that in there.
Yeah? It's just a remark. Maybe you can comment on it. I'm not sure what it implies or might imply, but I mean, it seems like you, from what you said, you got a lot of your results from, or the most important ones, from thinking about density matrices that admit more than one decomposition
yeah.
into pure state. But those are not generic. I mean, they're a set of measure zero among all density matrices. So what if we were to say...
Do you mean the density matrices that have degenerate eigenvalues?
Or do you mean... You're not referring to being necessarily orthogonal, is that it?
Yeah, so I'm not... You don't require them. Actually, one of the proofs that I use actually requires that there's a decomposition in one into an orthogonal basis and one into a set of non-orthogonal states. So I'm not requiring anything about orthogonality in my decompositions.
Oh, I see. Then I want to make a different comment. When you said that there's no way you can tell these two density matrices apart.
Yeah.
That's under a certain set of rules. But it's not clear why we have to follow those rules. If you knew how the density matrix was produced, then you would have extra information, knowing something about the history.
It's true that I would counter that you could be in a situation where, for instance, you told someone, you know, I've prepared this, you know, I've prepared a million steps, I've prepared this way, and then they just tell you, well, are you sure? And then you go, wait a minute. I don't know if I remember. Did I have my mirror set the right way on my optical table? And all of a sudden, you're no longer sure.
Yeah, but, okay, fine. And that's like an assumption that nature has to be described by some Markovian kind of... You're basically assuming that whatever is true about the past has to be registered in some sort of present state.
So that's the assumption.
That I think is a very questionable. I mean, in a history's approach of the sort that we've been working with, that many people actually have been working with, that's just not true in general.
Yeah. So here is the key point where I would draw your attention to the least controversial slide in this entire talk, and that is that. So it is definitely true that there are approaches and interpretations where Markovian dynamics does not seem to be a natural assumption. Then there are other approaches where it does. And so I would agree that it is possible. And it's worth exploring. I think particularly given that not everyone is happy with anything, that's a good indication that we should maybe try out everything to, you know, see if anything gets an answer. But, you know, in this language of faithful representations, it is a natural assumption to make.
Markovian.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about non-Markovian approaches?
A little, but not a massive amount, because for me the problem with non-Markovian approaches is I just don't...
Well, you know, an open system, just an open system.
Is
generically non-Markovian. If you try and describe it as an autonomous system, just a dynamics with that subsystem, tracing out the environment.
Yeah.
Then generically you get non-Markovian.
Though you can always go into the Church of the Larger Hilbert space and say, well, the non-Markovian behavior is just because you're tracing over ignorance. So.
In that example, it's true by construction.
Yeah. Not necessarily me. But
someone could always go and say.
Yeah. So this is part of the problem.
You're using a mixed state because you're just ignorant about the pure state. I mean, that is...
I agree. So these are just kind of some of the things that I don't know the answers to. I'm kind of still looking quite a lot, and I assume I will be looking for all my life, because I don't think I'll ever get completely satisfactory account. But maybe we will. Maybe someone will surprise me. With that depressing note, does that sound
Any more questions?